This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic. This week, I get to share with you one of my favorite conversations of the year, sitting with Lori Voss to talk about one of my favorite talks of the year, NPM and the future of JavaScript. If you haven't yet watched this talk, you have to. It is the best talk this year. And such a tremendous overview of the JavaScript ecosystem as a whole. If you want to see where things have been, where they're coming from, where they're going into the future, Lori Voss does an amazing job covering all of those details. And he sat down with me after his talk to go even further into what that means for you today as a React developer. I think you'll love this talk. It is a great one to end the year on. We'll dive in right after this. This episode of React Podcast is brought to you by React Training, in-person, hands-on training for development teams, provided by community leaders and experts. For more information or to find a workshop near you, visit reacttraining.com. This is React Podcast. I'm Chantastic, and today I'm sitting at JS Conf in Carlsbad with the incomparable, inimitable Lori Voss. He's the COO and co-founder of NPM, and we're going to talk about some of the stuff that he is up to right now. We got to speak at JS Conf this year, which is an amazing conference, and he had an amazing talk on a lot of things JavaScript called NPM and the future of JavaScript. And there was a lot in there for React developers. So we're going to talk about that. But first, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great today. I think I like the way that you refer to it as JSConf. I like how JSConf gets to be the default. Everybody else has to be JSConf somewhere.
Oh, that's right.
And
yeah.
JSConf US is just like, no, we're just JSConf.
We're just JSConf.
We invented this.
It's very American of me. Yeah, so how did you feel your talk went this week?
It seemed to go down pretty well. Very, very unusually, I had written it more than 24 hours in advance of the conference. Usually, how my conference talks go is I arrive with most of a talk written or even a whole talk written, and then I have like three or four conversations with people at the conference, and I'm like, this talk is garbage, and I need to talk about something completely different, and I rewrite it all the night before, and I finally had like the fortitude to not do that this time, and it was better as a result of having been like, you know, written and advanced and practiced and stuff. I should have more patience with my talks.
Yeah. We actually had the privilege of sharing a stage about a month ago at NEJS Conf. Were you as prepared then?
No, as you know, it was very similar to the talk that I gave here. The primary difference is where I updated it with another month's worth of data. And I also threw out a bunch of stuff that didn't land as much. I went hilariously over time at Nebraska JS. And so I boiled down what ended up being like 55 minutes of talk into like 34 minutes of talk. And it was, you know, it was more concentrated and more fun as a result.
Yeah, I felt like all of the jokes that you put in there were just pristine. They were really perfect. It worked really well.
I like being able to poke fun at people and then sort of, you know, like throw my hands up and go, it's just the data. I'm not making fun of you. It's just the data. The data's making fun of you.
This is your first time on the show. So I'd like to ask, how did you get into programming?
I'd sort of messed around with various kinds of programming as a kid. I'd like gone to like computer camps and things, and those things seemed interesting to me. But where it really got me into programming, like as a career, was the introduction of the web. Internet access arrived in Trinidad in like 1996. Mm-hmm. And I saw my first web page in like December of 1996. And I wrote my first web page like 4 hours later. It was very, very clear to me, like very instantly. I was like, I like this and I want to do this the rest of my life. And it's very strange to me that the decision I made when I was 14 years old has absolutely been true. That is exactly what I spent the rest of my life doing.
Do you remember what the first web page you made was?
The first web page that I made, it was, you know, what is the first web page everyone makes? It's like, here's my homepage. This is about me. I remember why I made it though. the homepage that was set by default by the ISP in Trinidad was Trinidad.net, which is defunct now. But Trinidad.net, it was a website that looked exactly as professional as any other website on the internet that day. I was used to living in Trinidad as like a backwater, right? Like our TV was crappy and our radio was unprofessional. And, you know, like our print ads weren't as like polished as what you saw on American cable. But our website looked just as good as the New York Times, just because there was only so much you could do with HTML in 1996. And the people in Trinidad could do exactly as much as the people at the New York fucking Times. And it was wonderful to me that I was like, I can be just as good as anyone in the world. This playing field is level right now, and I am on it. I am going to do this. And that was very clear to me, like from the get-go. I was like, I can do this just as good as anybody else.
Now, obviously, you've been working on the internet for a really long time. We've all started to see that kind of power start to like, people start to grab for power in the internet space. And so, do you feel like that's still true today, or is it less true, or is it more true for the people who are coming into the web right now?
That's a really good question. I think it is even easier now to produce a website of the complexity that I was producing in 1996. Mm. I could produce one of those in 10 seconds. In fact, I wouldn't even need to, right? Because you could make a website that is just as good as a homepage was back then by, you know, starting a Tumblr and typing into it, right? Like, you don't need to make a website to do that anymore.
Yep.
So a lot of people, I think, look at the complexity required to build what we would consider to be like a modern website and go, oh, this is much less accessible. And that's true, right? Like, I could learn literally all of HTML. I could learn in an afternoon in 1996, and there was no CSS and there was no JavaScript. I was done by the first afternoon. And now you could spend years just learning like the ins and outs of React, and you would be really good at one corner of one framework of the whole space of the web. So in that sense, it's harder, but on that, but like that's a function of because we do so much more stuff now.
Yeah.
So yes and no. It's harder to become a professional web developer now, but it is much, much easier to build websites.
I want to talk about your talk a little bit. There was a ton of data, and we'll link it. But I wanted to kind of like start with some of your stats and kind of the framework of the talk. So you said that 10 million people are using NPM right now?
Yep.
How many gigabytes are downloaded every week? Remember?
We download 6 billion packages a week.
Okay, 6 billion packages.
And in terms of how much data that is, I don't even know anymore. It's a lot. Although it's actually, we generate more in terms of log data than is actually downloaded. Most packages are quite small. So it's one of these weird features is like, I produce more data by recording what it is that people downloaded than they actually downloaded.
Yeah, yeah. 97% of app code is actually downloaded from NPM. Is that correct?
In a modern web application, so a React app is an excellent example, the application code that the developer themselves writes is about 3% of the total code in the application.
That is wild.
That's not like 97% of all application code everywhere, but modern web apps, the code that you write is only the last 3%.
Crazy. In your talk, you talk about how NPM had started originally as the Node Package Manager.
Yes.
Right? And how that is shifting, and the majority of users of NPM are using it to make web applications.
Indeed.
Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
So the stats are 93% of people who use NPM are using it to write code for the browser. That's not us guessing. That's us running a survey of 16,000 people and asking them, what are you up to? In that same group, 70% say they are writing some server-side code, but the focus for most people is front-end applications, and that is a total reversal of how NPM thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Right? We consider ourselves a Node company. I remember very distinctly because there was this gap in JS Conf's. So there was the last JS Conf I went to was 2015, and now I'm at JS Conf in 2018. And in that intermediate period was when this change really happened. And I remember in 2015, it was a little bit strange being NPM at JSConf because we would be like, hey, you want to talk about Node? And people would be like, no, I'm a front-end developer. And now every single talk is involving NPM. Every single front-end developer takes it for granted that you will be using NPM to put a front-end web application together. And that only changed in the last 3 years. It feels like bedrock now, but it was not at all true in 2015. People were like, I can build front-end web apps anyway. And now NPM is just the thing you use to build websites.
Yeah, no, that wasn't a foregone conclusion, obviously. It wasn't even something that you anticipated back in 2015.
It was something we were hoping to do. In 2014, we had a bunch of really serious conversations about like, what can it like front-end developers? There's so many more of them than there are node developers. That was clear even then. What can we do to make NPM attractive to front-end developers? Because there's this thing called Browserify, which lets you use node packages on the front-end. That seems really exciting. Seems like that's going to take off. What can we do about that? And we were like, you know, we were hemming and hawing. And in the end, we did what NPM frustratingly has to do quite often, which is go, we need to concentrate on keeping the registry up. We can't try and steer JavaScript at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what happened instead was that the front-end developers figured it out on their own. The Webpack folks came up and they significantly improved the ergonomics of Browserify. Browserify definitely invented the concept. Sure. All hail Substack. But Webpack really nailed it. And the result was just this explosion in front-end usage of NPM.
Does Webpack then seem like the inflection point?
In an ecosystem as complicated and as big as ours, it's very hard to point at any individual actor. But I will say that, pulling the stats out of my head again, I think it is something like 79% of people who use NPM are using a bundler of some kind, and 80% of those people are using Webpack. Webpack is the overwhelming choice for doing any kind of bundling. So clearly, Webpack has had a huge impact there.
What do you think some of the ergonomics were to Webpack that made it the front runner now over the originator of the idea, Browserify?
Browserify was unopinionated, and that was kind of its downfall. Webpack, right there in the name, it says Webpack. You are building a thing to put stuff onto the web. Browserify, James became sort of overwhelmed with the possibilities of what he had built. He had built this really amazing technology that could transfer one type of JavaScript into any other type of JavaScript, and the number of transforms you could apply was bewildering. And so he did this sort of like, you know, choose your own adventure situation with Browserify, whereas Webpack was like, we'll pick things for you. Developers hate having to make tooling choices. They would much prefer that the defaults work. And that's basically what's why Webpack is winning, which is interesting because, as you know, I mentioned later in the talk, one of the things that's most striking about React is that its huge success has come despite the fact that it is a choose-your-own-adventure situation, right?
Yeah.
It's like you have to make a Webpack in React, you have to choose a router and you have to choose a bundler and you have to do a bunch of other stuff. And it's it is a testimony to how powerful React is that people are putting up with that because they hate it. They really hate it.
So I came to React from a lot of experience in the front end, doing Angular 1 and then Ember, which was kind of my savior at the time because Angular was very opinionated and then Ember felt like magic because I could just use the Ember CLI. It did all the stuff that I didn't want to have to do. Mm-hmm. And then I was good to go. I could just start focusing on app code. Mm-hmm. And I realized that started to fall over when I was working in a company and we had these very established Rails apps that we wanted to just do a little bit more like interactive stuff on top. Mm-hmm. And it was almost impossible to get the Rails opinions and the opinionated Ember stacks to really work perfectly well together.
Yeah.
I know for us, like React was a perfect spot for us because it just gave us the component, which is what we needed since we already had a framework. In your talk, you mentioned that it seems like there's a lot of reversal of that right now. And it seems like the Vue might be kind of, and that opinionated mindset again, might be kind of chewing away at what React's doing.
To put in context, what I said in the talk was React's growth has been enormous. Something like 60% of NPM users are using React, which is absurd when you consider how many NPM users there are. And React's growth relative to other packages in the registry for the last 4 years has been amazing. But in the last 12 months or so, that growth has slowed down. And also in the last 12 months, the growth of Vue and to a lesser extent Ember has really picked up. So, correlation is not causation.
Sure.
But my guess is that Vue is stealing some of React's thunder, especially in terms of new users. Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to the point that I was making earlier, which is that Vue comes with defaults that work a lot more of the time, and you have to make fewer choices. And anecdotally, when I went on Twitter and was like asking people who've actively using Vue, what made you pick it over the alternatives, mm-hmm. that answer came up a lot. It was like a sort of sweet spot between the amount of flexibility and extensibility that it allowed, mm-hmm. but the lack of setup that it required.
Yeah. What are some of the successes that you've seen in the React space, given how modular it is and the fact that things can independently succeed apart from their relationship to React?
I think you're probably steering me towards a specific insight there, which is Flux. Mm-hmm. So when, again, as I mentioned in the talk, when React was released, Facebook released Flux at the same time. Mm-hmm. And Flux was how Facebook was managing state in very large applications for itself. And Facebook sort of expected that developers would use Flux as well, but it was kind of weirdly apologetic about it. It was like, you could do it this way, although it seems kind of overkill for most applications. Facebook was like, this probably won't work for you. You should probably write your own. So people started using Flux a lot, but Facebook was right. The ergonomics were not good for smaller web applications, where any app is smaller than Facebook. And so Redux came around instead. And as soon as Redux was available, Flux's usage began to fall off a cliff. Redux was a much better set of choices for that problem. And the thing that I was saying in the talk was that is a triumph of like a design decision, right? If you decide as React, we're not going to couple this component model to this data model, mm-hmm. because we don't think they're going to be as popular as each other. That was exactly right. Like if Flux had been coupled to React, then Flux being unpopular would have pulled React down with it.
Yeah.
And instead what happened is React continued to dominate. In fact, one of the best things about React is that it goes into a bunch of places where a web framework strictly doesn't need to go at all, right? Mm-hmm. People are building desktop applications in React. People are building mobile applications in React, right? Yep. React Native is a big deal. And that doesn't need a whole bunch of web framework stuff at all, right? You don't need a router. You don't need, a bunch of data model stuff that web apps need is just not present in React at all. And that means that React's potential range of applications is much broader, which is part of why it's getting so much usage.
We've seen a lot of development in the around GraphQL, mm-hmm. and there's two kind of competing or two front runner libraries in mm-hmm. terms of consuming a GraphQL endpoint, mm-hmm. Which are Apollo and Relay. Mm-hmm. Which one seems to be having the most success right now?
I hesitate to sound too authoritative on GraphQL, sure. because I am a complete neophyte on GraphQL, but the stats do say that Apollo appears to be running away with it. Apollo is something like four times as popular as any competitor that I could find. but like I said, I'm sufficiently ignorant about the GraphQL space that there literally could be some other package out there that I just haven't heard of yet.
So you made some bold predictions in your talk. Do you mind recapping some of those for us?
Sure, I can make the uncontroversial ones. The most uncontroversial one is that no framework is going to last forever. My examples were Backbone and jQuery. People like to hate on jQuery now. jQuery was an amazing, amazing invention mm-hmm. that completely changed the way that we use the web and that we program the web. And people sort of say that, jQuery's dead now. jQuery isn't dead now. jQuery transcended, right? Mm-hmm. Like document selectors, jQuery invented those and they're part of the browser now. jQuery was so useful, we built it into the browser and we didn't need jQuery anymore because now it's in everything.
Yeah.
But jQuery, the library, its heyday was only about 4 or 5 years. Backbone had a similar lifespan. React is 3.5 or 4 years into that cycle right now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think the most interesting thing about React is that it has the potential to do what jQuery did. It has the potential to transcend rather than decay. Because what tends to happen with frameworks is people use a framework, they love a framework, they learn from the framework, and they build a better version of that framework or a new framework that learns from the mistakes of the last one, and the new one takes off. And the old framework doesn't fall off of a cliff. People continue to maintain applications written in the previous framework, but they slowly retire those applications. And as a result, the usage for that for that library slowly decays and the new one begins to take off. And like by default, that will happen to React 2. By
sure.
default, that happens yep. to every library.
Yeah.
But there is a sort of escape clause, which is if React is so useful that we build it into browsers in the way that we built jQuery into mm-hmm. browsers, if the component model that React has introduced becomes a first-class construct to browser manufacturers, mm-hmm. which is not impossible,
sure.
then React could do what jQuery did and just sort of like, you know, ascend into the pantheon of like, it's web technology now. We don't even yeah. think of it as a library. And the thing that could do that for React is if React components are truly reusable. Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that I mentioned in the talk is this study by Leo Myrovich of programming language selection. He studied academically why people pick what programming languages they pick. You know, is it because they like the features, they like the language, they love the performance, mm-hmm. their boss tells them that they have to, you know, what are all the possible reasons? And over and above anything else was there was a library in that language that helped me do it. Mm. People will pick a language because of the libraries, not the other way around. Mm. That goes a long way to explaining JavaScript success because NPM is so big these days that people yeah. are being driven into JavaScript, sometimes against their will, just because there's so many NPM libraries that help them do what they want to do. If React's components are truly reusable, if it becomes the pattern that people start putting websites together, not by writing a bunch of HTML, but by installing a bunch of reusable React components and starting to glue them together at a higher level of abstraction, mm-hmm. there could become this sort of gravity well of really useful, reusable React components that keep sucking more people into React. They'll write more components. This ever-growing library of components will become unstoppable, and nobody will ever stop using React. That could happen. The odds are against it.
Sure.
But it is. I would say that if it doesn't happen in the next 18 months, it won't happen.
Okay. So the competition against something like that would be the work that's already happening in web components?
Web components are an interesting question. I went deep on web components recently because I was writing this talk and I was looking at that. And that is one of the potential conclusions of writing this talk is that maybe web components are what we're going to use to do this kind of stuff.
Sure.
And so I asked on Twitter for people who have actually built things in web components, how did you like it? And I explicitly said, if you've decided not to use web components and you think you know why, I am not interested in hearing from you. I do not want to hear all the clever reasons why you think web components are stupid. Those people can stay out of my mentions. Tell me, if you specifically wrote something yeah. using web components, what did you like about it?
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because a bunch of really good practitioners showed up in my mentions. And it turned into a sort of mini conference of people trading best wow. practices and things of like, you know, this is what we did and this is what worked and this is what didn't work. And the feedback was pretty universal that people liked the performance implications of having it built into the browser, mm-hmm. but the ergonomics of the technology itself were not good. Mm. They like the fallback position of being able to use a tag, and if the tag yeah. isn't supported, then you just get the content inside the tag. That's cool. But they really didn't like the fact that there's a lot of low-level DOM manipulation required to write the web components themselves. And in general, the whole abstraction is kind of too low level to be useful mm-hmm. or to be useful by itself. A lot of people are using a framework called Stencil with web components.
Yeah.
And if you're using a framework with something built into the browser, that kind of suggests that the level of abstraction is wrong, right? Like if you shouldn't need to if we got it right. Mm-hmm. So if you're going to replace React the framework with Stencil the framework, which is slightly less of a framework because some of it is built into the browser, have you really built something better or are you just doing the same thing a different way? And also the overriding feedback was like, they're not ready yet.
Yeah.
Like a bunch of them just isn't supported. And so it may not be fair to be judging them yet, mm-hmm. but I wouldn't go so far as to make a confident prediction about it, but my expectation of web components is not positive right now.
If the thing that excites most people are the performance implications of that, does it seem like possibly there's a future where React using WebAssembly as a target could bridge that gap?
That's a good question. I had one of the great things about conferences is you meet people you wouldn't otherwise meet. The PM for WebAssembly and a couple of the devs from V8 from Google are here. And I had a really fantastic conversation with them on the first night about WebAssembly and how to use it and where they expect it to go. And it's interesting because the WebAssembly guy obviously was like, yeah, WebAssembly is going to take over the world. Whereas the V8 guy was like, WebAssembly isn't actually that much faster than V8. He's like, JavaScript's fine. And I'm like, well, yeah. Of course you'd say that. You write V8. But the actual problem is that V8 right now, or rather WebAssembly right now, it can't talk to the DOM directly. Mm-hmm. If it's talking to the DOM, which is like what you're doing all of the time, it's as slow as JavaScript. In fact, it's slower than JavaScript because it's constantly crossing the blood-brain barrier from WebAssembly into JavaScript. Mm. There is a proposal, the native name of which I forgot. I think it's the native modules proposal or something along those lines that would let WebAssembly interact with the DOM directly. And if you did that, then you could write stuff that was WebAssembly and much, much, much faster probably.
Wow.
But that's embryonic. No one's even implemented it yet. They're still just talking about it. WebAssembly is probably not going to be any kind of short-term solution to a React performance problem. React doesn't have that much of a performance problem. What I think would be a really great idea, but it's just me, is one of the browser manufacturers should get, just say, this component thing and the JSX in there, I'm just going to make it a first-class thing. Mm. Like, every time somebody says, we should make JSX part of JavaScript, people immediately crawl out of the woodwork to say, oh, but it's fundamentally mutually incompatible with some of the existing language features of JavaScript. Backwards incompatible. You couldn't. I'm like, of course we could. Of course we could. We have made sense of much more complicated, mutually conflicting standards problems before. We just declare some stuff to not work anymore, right? Like, there's no marquee tag either. Like, you can, if something is sufficiently useful, we will stomp on backwards compatibility sometimes. And even if we don't, then you can put in feature flags or use strict or use JSX or some kind of flag that says this is a situation where JSX is going to be fine. I think we should build JSX into JavaScript, and I think we should make React components a first-class feature of browsers, and that would make them a lot more performant, and let's see what happens.
Do you feel that the React component model is ready at this point for something like that?
I think anything that has 6 million users is ready enough.
Okay.
And I also, having been in web development for 22 years, believe very strongly that standardization should follow the users and not the other way around. Mm. All of the times that the standards bodies have got together and said, we know how this is going to work, and put something together, it has been an abject failure. We did it with HTML3. We did it again with XHTML 2.0, a standard so bad that we threw it out without implementing it. We did it with a bunch of other XML-based things, like over and over and over. Every time we have a good idea, we standardize it, and then we give it to the standards bodies to take it to version 2, and the version 2 is so bad that no one uses it. So whether or not the people who make browsers and the people who standardize HTML think that React components are the best possible solution, they should look at the facts on the ground and say that everyone is using it already, so we should just let them use it and standardize it.
I'd be happy with that.
I mean, of course you would.
So tell me a little bit about React at NPM. You're using it for the front end of npmjs.com and .org, right?
Mm-hmm. It's funny that you should say .org. .org hasn't existed for 4 years, and it was so subtle nobody even noticed we retired it. .org is only the registry mm-hmm. itself, where everyone downloads the packages from, is npmjs.org, and specifically so that our website never takes down the registry. Those are separate domains. Yeah, so we use it on npmjs.com. My web team is going to be listening to this podcast and be like, now he's going to talk about stuff he doesn't know, because I didn't implement our website, obviously. Like, we have a bunch of people who did that. But I believe I am correct in saying that while we use React to do the dev mode, because it has really great debug tools, and in production, it is actually Preact. We made the trade-off there in terms of compatibility and performance and went with Preact as being a lot smaller and faster to deliver. And we've been pretty happy with it so far. Sort of the promise of React is really fast iteration, being able to reuse a library of components and stuff like that. And that's definitely paying off. It took us much longer than we wanted to rewrite our previous website in React components. But now that they are there, adding new pages is really fast, like really delightfully fast.
Yeah, I noticed after the incident with, I can't remember exactly which ESLint plugin it was.
It was ESLint itself.
ESLint itself, okay. I remember very shortly after you had all of these new features implemented where you could see, which users on which packages had two-factor auth enabled, et cetera, et cetera. And I was amazed at how quickly you rolled that UI stuff out.
So the UX stuff genuinely did get out the door really quite quickly. It was a little bit of a illusion quite how fast we appeared to be moving there. We were literally a week away from releasing that feature anyway.
Okay.
It was really annoying to us that we were about to release that feature and a security incident that was basically the result of the lack of that feature happened. Yeah. But we were like, hey, look at this thing we made earlier. It's a whole cake.
Because it might have been less likely to happen or been more visible if you'd been just right ahead of it.
It's one of those things when you make security tools that aren't by default, right? Like if everybody had, like we'd already released 2FA, and if everybody in the ESLint team had been using 2FA, then they'd have been fine.
Sure.
But also when you build security tools, you know that you can't blame the user for security failures. Mm-hmm. If a security incident has happened, it's because you put together a system where it was too hard to use the security, mm-hmm. or the security wasn't there. And in this case, it was the former. Mm-hmm. So, we should have made it easier for the ESLint team to be responsible, but we didn't. There were some ergonomics about automated builds and things like that that meant that it was convenient for that one person out of everybody who works on ESLint to turn off 2FA. Mm-hmm. And that turned out to be the weak link in the armor.
NPM is doubling, tripling, quadrupling down on security.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me a little bit more about what's going on there?
In the same set of survey data that we have been basing the rest of this talk on, we asked people a lot of questions about security. Something like 77% of people said that they were concerned about the security of the open source packages they use. Mm-hmm. That's not really surprising. Everyone should be concerned about security. But 52% of people said that the tools that they use, the tools available to judge the security of open source software were not good enough. And that's not great. That doesn't mean like, oh, it's too hard or it's too much trouble. They were like, the tools don't exist, was the message. Since the very beginning of NPM Inc. in 2014, we were like, and one day we should start getting into package security. And it was becoming a bigger and bigger problem that we couldn't hand wave away. And we were like, okay, this is going to be really, really expensive, but we are going to have to become a security company as well. That was not the plan. We had a plan that was going to get us to profitability. It was going to be great. And we had to be like, actually, no, we're going to have to take a bunch of our money. We're going to have to buy a security company. And we're going to have to become a security company. And it is going to push the whole plan out by a couple more years because it turns out security is too important to wait.
Yeah.
So that's what we did. Luckily, we had there was a company sitting there, the perfect company to buy, Lyft Security, who had been our security auditors since the beginning of NPM Inc. Adam Baldwin, in particular, was a personal friend to us as well as a really leading light in JavaScript security. And he'd also been sort of like batting down the door for a couple of years going, this is really stupid that I'm outside of NPM. We were like, we agree, but you're really expensive. But eventually we figured it out.
Yeah.
And so now Lyft Security is part of NPM Inc. And we've turned a bunch of Lyft's products into just features of NPM, which is honestly what they always should have been.
What does that look like as a consumer of NPM packages? How would someone use these security features?
So if you're using the NPM CLI, and you should be using the NPM CLI for this reason, whenever you run NPM install, it will automatically let you know. It will do what we call a quick audit, which is it will let you know if any of the packages that you've just downloaded contained any known vulnerabilities, whether they were critical or severe or high or whatever. If you are alarmed by that information and you run NPM audit, it will give you a lot more information about them, including how to fix them. And the good news there is that usually the act of discovering a security vulnerability means that the author of that package fixes it, which means that there's usually a new version of the package available which fixes it. So the NPM audit information usually consists of a bunch of instructions on running NPM again to upgrade packages to fix the security vulnerabilities. I wish I could say that it occurred to us the first time we put all of this together that if NPM is instructing you to run NPM, why doesn't NPM just run itself? But we didn't. We got all the way to releasing that feature before we were like, why does it just tell you to run NPM? So now NPM audit fix does that. NPM audit fix takes its own advice and runs NPM to fix all of your security vulnerabilities that it can, which is really quite magical, right? It's like it's quite a step change in 8 months to go from, well, I guess we need to do security to NPM is a piece of software that used to manage your packages, but now it fixes security holes in your software.
Right? Yeah, it's like, a huge difference.
That's a big transition in terms of value add as a tool.
So which version of NPM do you need to be on in order to take advantage of these amazing features?
Thank you for the softball. The current version of NPM is 6. I think we are at 6.4 right now. And that is what everyone should be on, because that's the one that has all of the performance improvements. NPM is something like 25 times faster than it was 2 years ago. It also contains all of the audit and audit fix functionality, which is really, really useful. And we are seeing real improvements in the ongoing security of open source JavaScript, just as a result of this sort of ambient information landing on developers these days.
Yeah. Is there any other NPM command that we should know of that might be hidden there that would make our lives way better?
The other one that I love to plug is right now is NPM CI. There's a very common trope in JavaScript land. If you run rm-rf node modules and then semicolon npm installed, you're like, blow node modules away and reinstall it. if you run npm CI, it will do exactly that, but it will be twice as fast.
Wow.
Where npm, that's sort of the party trick. Where npm CI is intended to be used is in continuous integration environments.
Okay.
The thing about continuous integration environments is that they tend to have that kind of shape. They tend to be a fresh VM with no cache and no packages and no node nodules folder. And as a result of knowing that we're running in that environment, NPM CI can be like, okay, I'm not even going to do all of this like tedious error checking. I'm just going to suck packages down from the internet and slam them onto your disk as fast as I can possibly do them. So NPM CI is really fun because it's literally limited by how many cores you have.
Wow.
It's not even how fast your network is, because the packages are quite small. If you put NPM CI on a supercomputer, it will go faster than if it's on your laptop. And you don't run into very many processor-limited web development use cases, I don't think, right? No one's like, my web app would go faster if I had more cores, but this one does.
This one does. When we were at NEJS, we were having a conversation, and someone asked about diversity in hiring, and you had a really interesting answer, and I'd love to kind of bring that back up again, but you said something about how NPM has been diverse from the beginning and how that's really shaped the way that hiring has happened throughout the whole process.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk more to that?
I would not want to say, I think it is taking too much credit to say that NPM was diverse from the beginning.
Okay.
NPM, by some standards, was more diverse than other companies in Silicon Valley was from the beginning. NPM was more queer than the average company. It had more Hispanic people than the average company. And it had a better gender balance than the average company. And all of those things have remained true. And the weirdest thing is they've remained true in almost exactly the same ratio since we were 5 people to when we were 35 people.
That's crazy.
The same ratios that were in the first 5 people are still true. But there are lots of axes of diversity, and we are not present on some of them.
Sure.
We're good at age diversity. We do not have as much racial diversity as we want. There are, there's a zillion intersectional axes of diversity, and I would not yet call us a fully diverse company, but we're doing okay. And the interesting thing about it was that those ratios were so locked in.
Mm-hmm.
The company you are at the very beginning is pretty much the company you stay. And you can see that happening in companies from every size, from us to Google. The company that Google was when Google was 10 people, it's still the company that Google is. And Google is spending, millions upon millions of dollars trying to stop it.
Yeah.
But they're still exactly the company they were when they started. They're still like, if you don't have a PhD, we're kind of going to look at you funny, right? That was true of Google in 1999, and it's still true of Google like 20 years later, which is bizarre because they're like, we know, we have data, we've done incredibly expensive studies that's a stupid way on which to hire, but it's still the way Google is.
Yeah,
it's not a great message for diversity. It's like,
sure.
if you mess it up in the first 10 minutes, you're done. Right? You have one chance to get it right. And after that, there's nothing you can do.
Do you have any insights into why that might be?
The overriding thing that brings people to a company is networks. People hire their friends. They tell their friends, this is a good, safe place to work.
Mm.
And because hiring is so broken in most of Silicon Valley, people trust their friends' recommendations over any other signal. First off, the signals are really crappy. Like a job description is like, can you imagine if you wanted to get into if you wanted to marry someone and they were like, I think you should marry me. Here is a 4-paragraph description of what marrying me would be like.
Keep it to one page, please.
Right. And you're like, okay, well, you've obviously only written the good things about yourself. I think I'm ready to marry you. That's how we do job descriptions. We at best, we're doing 4 or 5 hours of interviews, and even that is a lot of trouble. Like it's a ridiculously small amount of information that we make these decisions on. And as a result, people don't trust it. So people use, oh, my friend works there, and they say it's good.
Yeah.
And so if you get your network set correctly at the beginning, that network perpetuates itself. People hire people like themselves because those are the people they know.
So we're going to wrap up in just a second, but I wanted to ask you about a community that you started. One of my hopes for the show is that as people learn about open source communities or Slack communities, they'd be able to find safe places to communicate, share their experiences, hear from other developers that maybe had shared experiences. And you started LGBTQ.technology, and it's a Slack group.
Yep.
And can you tell me more about that?
The funny thing about LGBTQ Slack, as we usually call it, is that it was almost entirely an accident.
Okay.
One of the things that I've done in my life repeatedly is formed online spaces for queer geeks. It's just the thing that I do. I still own, in fact, a domain called gaygeeks.org, where I created a forum which is like specifically for that.
Awesome.
And there were a bunch of other times that I've done this in my career in the last 20 years. And so it was almost an afterthought. In like 2014, I was like, this Slack thing seems to be taking off. And in fact, it was literally because Slack had added the feature of being able to have multiple Slack groups in the client at the same time.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, I'm only in one Slack and I want to see what that feature looks like. What Slack should I create? I know, I'll create a queer Slack. I tweeted, if I created a queer Slack, would anybody join? And immediately like 200 people were like, yeah, obviously we would. And so I created it mostly just to see what the Slack client looked like with two Slacks in it. And now there's like 4,000 people in it.
Wow. Amazing.
I would say that it wasn't what I intended, but what I intended was just, you know, there to be queer people in a Slack. And it's very much that. It's very different from what I would have expected.
Sure.
It is a space that prioritizes safety. Of marginalized groups over basically anything else. And that makes it a very good place for some people and an uncomfortable place for some other people.
Sure.
But I sort of like it for that.
Yeah.
And it's very self-regulating. When I say I started it, starting it is basically all that I did. Very quickly, a group of the heaviest users sort of, you know, self-identified as being as like, we should be the admins. And I'm like, you're right, you should be the admins. And I made them the admins. And now they, you know, as people have moved on and stuff, they've like nominated their successors and it's entirely self-regulating.
That's awesome.
And there's hundreds of channels in it, you know, like from local neighborhood groups to like, you know, people looking for jobs or people talking about JavaScript or people talking about whatever, you know, technology thing is, you know, like romantic topics, all just every possible subgroup and combination is there. And there's this, you know, amazing hierarchy of like how safe a channel can be. So there's like a flirting channel and then there's like a flirting channel, but where it's PG rated. And then there's a flirting channel where it's R rated. And like, they're like, we're going to make very clear that no one's going to be uncomfortable because the channel name is going to be 400 characters long.
You know exactly what you're getting into.
Right, exactly. But yeah, it's a really great space. And there've been a lot of success stories from it. Like people have got jobs, people have like found partners, people who are in remote locations have just been like, oh, it turns out I can be a web developer and gay at the same time. And I didn't know that that was going to be okay. So I'm super happy it exists.
How far does it reach? Is it mostly US folks? Is it all over the world?
It is mostly English speaking, but it is fairly widely geographically distributed. I tend to mention it whenever I go to a conference, and I've gone to conferences all over the place. So there's a sizable South American contingent.
Oh, awesome.
A big chunk of Europeans are on there. Yeah.
Is there a question that you would have liked to have been asked, but I did not ask it?
Does NPM have any useful paid products for React developers?
Does NPM have any useful paid products for web developers?
It absolutely does.
Tell me about them, please.
If what you're doing is you are putting together React components in particular, one of the things about React components is that they are intrinsically packageable, right? They have a package JSON at the root, and you can put them together that way, and you can NPM install them. So if you're the thing that you're doing with React is you're using it to collaborate across multiple applications that are sharing these components, then a really great way to do that is to use private packages to do it, because you can just NPM publish your component, and then anybody else in your company can NPM install the component into their application, and all of the same sort of good developer ergonomics of an NPM package apply. So you can be like, okay, well, you know, Our new calendar component is backwards incompatible, so we've created a breaking change version of the calendar component, but you can still use version 2.
Right.
And we don't have to, like, all, you know, fight over a monorepo, you know, like all of the same problems that it solves for open source, it can solve for a group of people who are collaborating on web components. And it's really useful for that.
Yeah. Now, the ergonomics of that really don't change from any type of NPM organization at all, right? So if you're already namespacing some of your components through at your organization, creating a private organization is just about turning that feature on, right?
Yes, although private organizations come with other features like security and auditing and things like that. Once it's private, you can say, well, only people in this organization have access to it, so we know exactly who was using it and why they were using it and stuff like that. If you're a company of the size where you're like, we need to know where this went and who was using it. And also a lot of people are just like, I don't want to put all of my, you know, every single button component I've ever created on the public internet. Could I keep them private, please?
I'd like to hide my shame.
Yeah, exactly.
Are there further products for people who need to control their own distribution?
Yes. NPM Enterprise, if you are a larger organization, can act as a sort of firewall between you and the public registry. Mm-hmm. You know, you can use sort of big company features like single sign-on and stuff like that. You get your own registry domain that you can point your clients at. And so you can know every single package that's coming into your company and where it went and what it was and, you know, whether it was secure or not and if you need to fix that, deploy, those sorts of things. Which big companies do really care about.
So who in this JavaScript space is doing work that you are really excited about right now?
GraphQL is probably my thing to watch in 2019. That trajectory is really amazing, suggesting that it will be a big thing, if not the next big thing. I'm sort of rooting for Ember this year.
Ember had
a rough patch in 2016. It was popular in 2015. It became less popular. It looked like it was, you know, on track to die, and it rebounded. Ember's growth has doubled in the last 8 months.
That's wild. That seems bizarre.
It's unprecedented for a framework. I've never seen a framework come back.
Yeah.
You know, they made some really substantial changes to how they work, you know, with Glimmer and all of those other changes. So it is a new framework with the old name, really. Mm. But I'm sort of rooting for them. I've always liked the people who actually do that work are really nice people. So I'm really glad to see their work getting the attention it deserves.
Well, thank you so much for taking this time to chat with me. I hope that you enjoy the rest of your pool time here at JSConf US. Thank you for correcting me on that. And I hope that we'll be able to talk again soon.
Thank you for having me.
That's it for this episode of React Podcast. To find out more about anything mentioned in the show, visit reactpodcast.com/33. Now, this is actually the last episode of the year, so thank you so much for sticking with us this entire year. I had a great time, and I hope that you did too. We've already got a lot of great interviews queued up for January. I can hardly wait to share them with you. If you have someone you'd like to see on the show, hit us up on Twitter. We're at React Podcast. There's so many amazingly talented people in our industry, and we rely heavily on your recommendations. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting the show. We'll be in your ears again next year.